Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you control your own destiny, your own identity? Our lives can be shaped by other people's secrets, by their perceptions of us, and by the myths we build out of our own stories. In the new novel, The 100-Year Flood, we follow a Korean-American college student named T to Prague soon after 9/11. Drawn to the city for the anonymity he hopes it will offer, T moves there to grieve for an uncle who treated him like a son and who killed himself over his distress at an affair between his wife and T's father. Soon after he arrives, T is spotted by an artist and his wife who invite him to model for a series of paintings, an arrangement that will have shattering consequences for all three. Author Matthew Salsis is here to talk about his work. He has written about adoption and race for NPR's Code Switch, the Motherlode blog at the New York Times, and Salon. Matthew, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
I am always interested in stories that explore identity. Your protagonist here, T, knows he was adopted by white parents after his birth mother died in Korea, so he's grown up with this sense of being tied to his family while somehow not entirely belonging with them.
Yes, that's right. So he has this kind of idea of himself from his adoptive parents, or who he thinks are his adoptive parents, and that's kind of driving his sense of identity from the beginning of the book. And the kind of mystery and the myth making that goes along with that, since he doesn't really know his birth parents and where he came from, kind of causes this sort of forward push for him to try to figure things out in a city that he doesn't really belong to.
And he doesn't necessarily go to Prague thinking that that's the question he's there to answer. He goes because he's dealing with this kind of horrible grief that everyone else refuses to acknowledge because of the circumstances surrounding it.
Yes, he's running away. So I, too, spent a year in Prague in 2004. And I often kind of had this question where people would ask me, like, why are you in Prague, or why did you go to Prague? And I never really had a good answer for it. There were, in some ways, it was the year before I went to Korea for the first time, and I'm adopted from Korea. And in some ways, I was kind of just avoiding going to Korea, and I was able to figure something out through being in another country that wasn't the country of my birth that helped me to kind of finally get to where I was going. And for T, it's a similar-ish situation where he's in Prague not for any very good reason other than a kind of romantic idea of it that stems somewhat from his uncle.
I was thinking about the fact that your adoptive parents, your parents are white. Is that correct?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, the work that you've done for Code Switch, how interesting to code switch almost into the ethnicity that you were granted at birth by virtue of biology, because I would imagine the culture that was most familiar to you in childhood was sort of white American culture.
In some ways, I've always felt like I was code switching, I guess, that I've always been put in a situation where people treat me as if I'm code switching when I'm speaking with no accent, or when I'm taking classes in English instead of math. And so I had this, I grew up with this kind of feeling that I was somebody that nobody else could see, and that I had to kind of code switch into a person that was acceptable in order to, you know, have a kind of acceptable place in society.
If you'd been adopted from Russia, you still might not look like your parents, but maybe it wouldn't be so obvious to people. Do you think there's a factor of, you know, your Asianness that causes people to particularly treat you as different?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe more so kind of from an external standpoint, that being Asian in a very white town with white parents and white friends meant that that was kind of more on the surface, the difference that was always there at the surface for me. And the adoption part was a more internal, you know, inside out difference that I was always aware of and that everyone else was aware of, but wasn't as much on the surface as being of a different race.
How was that story framed for you when you were little, and how much of that did you give to your character T in the way he sort of understood his adoption as a child?
Well, I was told when I was little, or really not told so directly, but it was often implied that I should be grateful for the life that I have here, and that I had been kind of saved from a worse life in Korea. Sometimes that was very directly said to me, and sometimes it was more of an implication. And so I kind of grew up with this odd standpoint toward my birth country, where I thought of it as a kind of terrible and yet alluring place, that it was some place that was so bad that I had to be rescued from it, but also was kind of the only place where I might feel at home. Or that's what people kept telling me, right, when they were saying, go back to your country or something. Mm.
Was that idea that you were lucky, and this is like the standard American narrative, right, for foreign adoptees, that the parents right. are so selfish and the children are so lucky, which doesn't leave a lot of room for those adopted children to work through that the reality that in gaining a family in the U.S., they lost one, by definition, in the country they came from.
You feel kind of absence of agency, that you have no control over your life, and you don't have a control over your identity either, that it's been given to you, and that the identity that has been given to you is something that you should be very grateful for, and how could you dare question that? And so that story then becomes the dominant story of who you are, and it's very hard, I think, to get away from that and to try to get to a place where you can think of yourself individually from a position that doesn't have to do with that story.
So I want to be clear that we're talking about a novel here. This is not a memoir, because there are some similarities, but I don't want to make any implications about your family or your situation. But with T's story, it occurred to me that it's possible to have adoptive parents or biological parents who just aren't so great at raising kids, right? I mean, there can be trauma from things, and then there can also be, some people are just not so good at raising kids to feel comfortable and good about themselves.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to be a parent. I mean, I think that's something I've learned in the last 4 years of being a parent. It seems like I couldn't imagine it being very easy. And I know, that my parents did the best that they could. And in a way, T's parents, or at least his mother, does the best that she can. And his father, I think, thinks of himself as doing the best that he can, though it's clearly not that great of a job, I guess, as a parent. But yeah, so it is a novel, and there are some similarities to me for sure. But in a large part, I didn't really realize how many similarities until much later on, that I thought it was that I was writing a book that didn't really have to do with adoption. And it wasn't until very much at the end that I realized it did have something to do with adoption.
I thought it was really interesting because we won't do a lot of spoilers here, but at the end of the book, T and another character are in like existential danger, and this is really what should be consuming him. But his mind keeps coming back to these identity questions, and even he's telling himself like this is not the time for this, but he can't let it go.
Who you are is so important, right? That how do you know how to act if you don't know who you are? I mean, there's something about even writing a character where when I'm teaching creative writing, I think I talk about how if you put a character in a situation that many people face, right, where, I don't know, they have to get to work as quickly as possible. Some people would do one thing, but if your character does something completely unique, that's telling the reader who he is or who she is in a way that is kind of very good at encapsulating who somebody is, because the way that we act is a part of our identity. And for T, he doesn't know what that identity is, so he's not sure how to act. He's not sure how much of his actions come from who he is kind of inside versus who he has been told that he is.
And he's also, it's important to reiterate, he's 20 or 21. That's a time when lots of people are having an identity crisis.
Yes, sure, for sure. I think that's an important part of it.
Did your relationship to his identity crisis, given that you have been writing this book since the time that you were just a little bit older than he is in the story, and now you're in your 30s, I wonder if your relationship to his confusion changed over the years.
It did. I didn't realize, I guess, how much of an identity crisis I was having when I was 22 until I could kind of look back on it from a much later time. So it took me 10 years to write this book, and part of that was I started the book with that sense of confusion, and I knew that T was somebody who was confused and in a confusing situation, as, you know, as an Asian American in Prague, in a place where there are very few kind of Asian Americans, though tourists, of course. And I wanted to kind of capture that confusion and loss, but I didn't really know where it was coming from. I mean, I thought I knew it was where it was coming from, but it took me 10 years really to figure out that it was coming from a similar place to where it was coming from for me when I was in Prague, that really so much of that was an identity crisis that he doesn't admit to himself that he's having.
Hmm. It is interesting that he and you choose a city where you're almost guaranteed to stand out from the crowd as being one of the only ethnically Asian faces walking around.
Well, I guess there's a way in which that's a time when you can feel, I mean, anytime you're going to a place that nobody knows you, right, there's a chance to remake yourself.
Mm.
And if you're going to a place where nobody knows you, but they're looking at you and thinking of you in a certain way, and it's not America, which is a little bit different, then you can kind of, when I was in Prague, right, like people would look at me and they would think Korean. And that was really one of the times where I felt like I had the freedom to be Korean in a way that didn't feel like it was taking away a part of my identity, as it was in America. And then after that, going to Korea was a totally different experience where I felt like, you know, I thought that I would be able to be Korean there, and yet I felt even more American. So there are these odd separations between different places.
Yeah, I'm so interested in the way that, you know, we all have stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and how we came to be the way we are and the values that we have. And it's really easy when you haven't had access to a part of your story, to a place that it figures into your origins, to really idealize that, right? To romanticize it, to imagine that, you know, everything would have felt perfect if you'd been in that place.
Yeah, I think there's a way in which you mythologize anything that you don't really know, and especially about yourself. And that can be, everything might be perfect, right? Or, you know, maybe I was the son of a king, you know, or something.
Right.
But it can also be terrible, right? That everything was awful and that's why I was given up. Or, you know, maybe I would have had a really terrible life there. Or maybe my parents died. Like, you know, you don't know, and it's, you don't really, I guess most people probably aren't imagining for themselves a kind of ordinary in the middle ground existence. They're kind of imagining the worst that could happen or the best that could happen.
Yeah, we're all like the main character in the most fascinating movie that we've ever seen, right?
Well, that's the great thing about stories, right?
Yeah. All right, we're talking this hour with Matthew Saleses. He's a novelist who has written about race and adoption in a nonfiction form for NPR's Code Switch and for Salon and the New York Times Motherlode blog. He has a new novel out. It's called The 100-Year Flood. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist and writer Matthew Salesis. His new book is called The 100-Year Flood. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, Matthew, Teague goes to Prague. He's in like a public square. He gets a little bit drunk. He's acting crazy. He takes his clothes off. He's approached by this couple who say, we want you to model for a series of paintings. And it's a really interesting thing that they have found him in this crowd, found something interesting about him. He doesn't seem to really even ask himself what it was that drew them to him, which is an interesting thing. For me, it was for me as a reader.
Yeah, I think he thinks of himself as, of course, that somebody would want to paint him, that he's, you know, like that, what drives him to strip his clothes off, that kind of feeling of strangeness in a place where he really is kind of one of a kind in a way, is something that maybe that people would want to depict, right? That and he's also kind of, you know, like he's 22, right? And so he has this very self-centered view of himself, maybe that, and he, you know, he's the center of his world for sure.
It does seem interesting, you know, to give yourself over as a model for something like a painting that is not strictly a portrait. There's going to be some interpretation there. You're asking someone to read you.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. I like that. For him, I think there's a feeling that if this famous artist can depict him, then maybe he has a place in this city, which he chose somewhat arbitrarily and doesn't really know why he's there, that somebody could kind of create his identity for him, and they were given a place there. And so he's kind of repeating this denial of who he is or seeking identification through somebody else.
So the artist who calls himself Pavel Picasso is in a sort of, in the throes of a sort of identity crisis himself. He was kind of a force in the Velvet Revolution, but then that ended, and he's left with this question of who he is now.
When are we not in an identity crisis? That's what I'd like to know, I guess.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think there's, just personally, that it can be good for life to be in identity crisis mode all the time, that if you're constantly kind of reevaluating who you are, then you're constantly improving as a person. Hopefully that's the end result. But for Pavel Picasso, it's different, that he thought he had a set identity, right? That he had made this kind of name for himself as a revolutionary and a revolutionary painter. And that identity has no value in the world that he's living in, that the world has changed and he hasn't changed with it. And so the crisis kind of comes from not reexamining himself from year to year and kind of letting it kind of all happen at once too late.
Yeah. And he's got this this story in his own background that T instantly recognizes for what it is, even though Pavel doesn't seem to understand it. The secret police come when Pavel is just a child. I guess he's about 12 or 13, and he's been doing some painting. Can you sort of tell us a little bit about what happens in that scene?
So his father was also kind of a major revolutionary figure and before the revolution, but somebody who was kind of fighting the regime through his art. And he's abducted twice. And the first time, the secret police come to the house, and his father and his mother have been kind of expecting them, but Pavel doesn't realize this since he's so young. And in their waiting, his father starts to teach him how to paint and wants Pavel to kind of carry on that legacy. And when the secret police come, his father has to kind of cover up the fact that his son has been painting these too, and that maybe that they're all his art, and so that he's the only one who gets into trouble for it. And so he takes claim of the art. And in order to do that, he has to say that his son kind of has no talent as an artist, and these paintings couldn't possibly be his, and even misidentifies the painting that Pavel was painting. And this seems like this kind of huge loss for Pavel, because he doesn't really understand that his father is trying to protect him. And even after he realizes that, it's at such a stage that where the story has already been set in a way, and that he already feels hurt, even though he knows at a later point that his father was trying to protect him. I mean, I think of the kind of the injuries that can be done to us as a child, or the injuries that we feel as children, that they don't go away. You can kind of reframe them, but they can still hurt in a way.
Yeah, I was really taken by that because it gets to the reality of the fact that sometimes it's like the intention should always matter when we consider things that have happened to us, ways that we've been hurt or treated well. But sometimes it doesn't matter what the intention was. The emotional effect was what it was, and it's hard to sort of shift from that.
I mean, that's what I think about all the time with adoption, I guess, that there's so many good intentions there, but in the end, the adoptee ends up often kind of even intrinsically torn from a life that she knows, and there's injury there, right?
Can adoptive parents possibly get it right?
Sure. I mean, I think, what's that book about, The Good Enough Parent, that... In all ways, right, that there's no way to be a perfect parent. There's no way to be a perfect adoptive parent either. And getting it right is, I guess, kind of doing one's best to provide the room, I think, for an adoptee to kind of create his own identity and to have access to and to feel less like he's... Like, for me, it was kind of being closed into a box of what I was or who I was. And I didn't feel like I had the chance to define that for myself. And I think a parent could, in many cases, you know, adoptive or not, try to give one's child the situation where she can kind of come into her own. I mean, like, that's what I'm trying to do with my kid. But it's so hard. It's mm-hmm. It's really such a difficult thing. And even when you think you're doing something well, you might end up hurting your kid and not even knowing about it, like Pablo's father does to him.
Now that you have your child, your daughter, and forgive me for asking this, except this is the kind of conversation we're having. Your daughter is your biological daughter, yours and your wife's. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah.
Do you have too much invested, or do you worry that you run the risk of having too much invested now in biology, in the nature rather than the nurture of raising her and trying to understand who she is?
I don't. I worried before she was born. I had this idea that it all was nurture, you know, that as an adoptee, that was all I knew. And so I thought like that nature kind of accounted for a very small percentage of what happened and who we were. You know, my parents, when I was growing up, would say like, oh, you bite your fingernails because your father bites his fingernails. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe that's true. I mean, they would even say, like, you get this or that, or like, you know, from your father, from your mother. And then my daughter was born, and she was born, you know, I had this weird idea that she would be born as a blank slate, and that everything, you know, that we did as parents would kind of build them into who they are.
Right.
And then she was born with this complete personality. Yeah, right. And then I had this feeling where like, oh, she's a complete person, like a complete personality. Like, I knew exactly how you could tell how far she would go to get what she wanted, and it was different from other people. And then I had this feeling like, wow, these are like these perfect beings that come out, and then maybe all we do is like kind of try to keep that perfection, and it's so hard that you could corrupt it at any time. And so now I guess I worry more about the nurture part, much more about the nurture part, because of the way that I can see her kind of starting to change now as a 4-year-old, that I felt like for the first 3 years of her life, she was still exactly who she was when she was born. And now I can see society and even us like kind of pressuring her to be something, and her either resisting or accepting that it is starting to change who she is. And it's hard. It's hard to watch that, I think.
I want to talk a little bit about the flood. I'm not going to give too much away about the end of the book, but the title is The 100-Year Flood, so people can imagine that there's one coming. So T and Katka, who is the wife of Pavel, are together in this flood. They've been warned to get away. And he keeps resisting. The idea is, you know, that he just wants to stay and ride it out. And it's kind of, you know, knocking over walls in the city, and they don't get out before it comes. And I wondered if his resistance to that, the idea that he would be fine, was kind of a symbol of his Americanness, right? This sense that the rules, including the rules of nature that apply to everybody else, don't affect us.
Oh, I love that. I mean, I love that reading of it. Just like there are so many things that he's grown up with that make him feel invincible, I think, right? Being a 22-year-old American male. I remember feeling like nothing could hurt me then, too. And then he's also so distracted by the identity crisis that he is having. And he feels as if this is like the one chance to kind of solidify his relationship with Katka, because he knows now that Pavel is out there and can do him harm and do their relationship harm. And so he, in his kind of weird way of thinking, thinks of it as a kind of opportunity to be stuck in a place with somebody that he loves, and to strengthen that relationship while they're stuck together.
He misses a really important detail that ends up mattering a lot. And I wonder how much he thought about how that character could possibly care about Katka and not understand this thing that is happening to her.
I did think about that, but I guess what I thought was, we do so many injuries to each other without knowing that we're doing them, right? Mm. That even the people we love most, or maybe especially the people we love most, that sometimes when we, for T especially, it's this kind of like desire so much for love and identity, and Katka is for him this kind of person who can deliver all of this, right? This finally somebody who loves him, who's, you know, 12 years older than him, is a kind of mother figure, and there's all of these things going on where what he wants so badly is getting in the way of him being able to kind of really assess what the situation is. And I think that happens a lot to us as human beings, driven by desire.
Have you experienced anything like the flood that you describe in this book?
No, I haven't. I've never been in a flood that bad. Though I live in Houston now, and there are occasionally floods that are sudden and can do a lot of damage. But no, I've never been in a natural disaster, really.
How did you research floods and what they do and the way they might affect an ancient city like Prague? And how much did you want to know, and how much did you want to leave and trust to your imagination?
I did a lot of research on this particular flood, following people's personal accounts of what had happened. And I found some great accounts where people would kind of write down the hour and what exactly was happening to them at that hour of the day. And so I could tell like how high the water was in Karlin and what the damage was. You know, I started to research like when it was raining. And so like the days in the book when it's raining are the same as the days it was actually raining in Prague during that time. And I wanted to kind of have all of the realities of what the flood was like, so that there would be no question of the flood, and the question would be, you know, on T and Katka and their situation.
And there are some really, they seem very dreamy, these scenes of animals who have been stranded at the zoo, which is on a little island sort of bit of land, being airlifted out. But those were based in reality.
Yeah, those all happened. There was a couple of seals that got loose, and one swam very far all the way into Europe, you know, searching for the ocean, I guess, and ended up dying very sadly, you know, so far from the zoo. Those details really stuck with me, and it seemed to have their kind of own kind of accrued meaning.
Yeah, it sort of, you know, I think reminds people of biblical imagery. It's almost fable-like when you're reading it all happening.
Yeah, you can write about a flood, and like it just becomes a symbol, even when you don't, even when you're not trying to make it into one. I mean, that's part of the power of these images, that, you know, floods and other natural disasters, or statues, or, you know, we have all kinds of images that we have, that we give so much meaning to and so much value to, and those can all be, used as a writer, I guess, to evoke more emotion from the reader.
Yeah, and I was thinking about the way we talk about emotion. You know, we say, it washed over me. I was, you know, inundated by this. And we have a lot of kind of flood terminology that we apply to the ways that we feel.
It's an enduring image. And for T2, there is this kind of flood, right, that's coming at him figuratively, and that he also refuses to acknowledge. And those two floods kind of converge on him.
And can you talk about his container? This comes up over and over in the book when he's kind of processing memories or emotions. He has in his mind this image of a container within himself.
Well, this came to me pretty late in the process where I was trying to figure out how to describe the kind of person that he is, a person who lets everything kind of build up and then reacts with this large action that, you know, like this, my, in some ways, I sometimes feel like a person who kind of will let anything go up to a certain point, and then I may react in the best ways. And for T2, he's a person who, because so much is going on outside of him, and he's been taught to accept so much, will really take on a lot. But then when it gets to be too much, when the container is full, he just dumps it all out in one move, that he'll do something reckless, like breaking up with his girlfriend and moving to Prague in a week, you know, that these things, that there's a kind of reaction there that isn't, he's not a passive character, but he's passive up to a point, and then he becomes an extremely active character.
We're speaking this hour with writer Matthew Salesis. He's written about race and adoption for NPR's Code Switch and Salon and the New York Times Motherlode blog. We're talking today about his new novel, The 100-Year Flood. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by emailing think@kera.org. You can also call 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet. I'm @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Matthew Salesis. His new novel is called The 100-Year Flood. If you can, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org, which is where we hear from Connie in Fort Worth, who asks, did you find in writing this book that you were able to explore some of your own feelings about being adopted and being from another country that you didn't realize you had prior to writing the book? And would you consider adopting a child either domestically or from abroad?
Well, those are good questions. I mean, for me, I did have to think about things that I had to, that I had not wanted maybe not to face in writing the book. That what happened was, when I was in my very final round of edits, and I had to kind of turn this book into something that I wanted to be a lot better than it was, I went to this football game with a writer that I know, and he was talking about a book that he had written, he thought, to an ex-girlfriend. And he had spent, you know, a few years writing this book to an ex-girlfriend, the one that got away. And then he had come to his own final edits, and he had asked himself the question, you know, am I really still hung up on this X, like, enough that this whole book, you know, is really about her? The answer he came to was that he wasn't really, that he, maybe through writing the book or whatever, had fallen away from this idea and had realized that what was really important to him was his daughter, and that the main character in the book, what was really important to him was his daughter, and that that was really the heart of the book, and he'd had to reroute the entire book so that that was clear to the reader. And so I sat there listening to this story, and I thought to myself, that sounds really difficult, and it would be a very hard thing to do. And I said, I don't want to do that. And then I went home and I thought about how people I knew were going to read the book, that people I respected as writers and as people would read the book and judge, you know, the writing, but also the author. And so I said, okay, I've got to do this. So I sat there in my room and I tried to think, like, what was I really thinking about when I was 22 in Prague? Like, what was I trying to hide from myself? Because I knew he was hiding something from himself. You know, the entire book, he's very much in denial. And I had to realize in the end that what I was hiding from myself at 22 was what he was hiding from himself, that adoption is so much on his mind, and that so much of what he desires, so much of what's driving the book is this desire to kind of know his birth mother and to know where he came from, and to have some connection to the woman who gave birth to him. And that was a hard thing for me to realize too. I think even though I've written so much about adoption now, it's still a difficult thing to have to look into yourself and see that so much of it you're hiding.
Hmm. I read somewhere, I don't know if this is accurate or if they were talking about this book, but you wrote about 1,200 pages. This book is 228.
Yeah, I would guess probably more of that in the end. Not all in one go, but I rewrote the book several times, probably four times from scratch. And each time I read a whole book, and then with all the revisions, you know, probably even more pages than that. You have to write a lot, or I do at least, in order to kind of figure out what are the important parts are and then to get it down to those things.
How have you learned to be the kind of writer who knows what to cut?
That's a great question. I think of writing usually as a sort of decision-making process, in that at every moment you're making a decision. You're making a decision to choose this word or to start the novel in first person or third person, to where you're setting the book. And every sentence you're kind of making decisions about what those words are and how they lead into the next sentence. And so as I've gotten, you know, as I've written more and more, I've started to think that all writing, good writing really is making good decisions. And I try hard to kind of think of all the very minor decisions that go into writing at every point, and that they aren't always these big things about, like, what will happen in the book. Sometimes they're, you know, why did I put a bird in this sentence? Maybe it was for a reason I didn't realize, or maybe it was something that didn't need to be there, and then I will cut it. And so that's how I kind of approach the revision process.
It sounds a little bit like trying to raise your daughter and make the right decisions every day. And some of them matter a lot and some of them don't, but you want to get them all correct.
Yes. Yeah. That the book, it has its own kind of life and it's growing and it's sometimes talks back to you. And hopefully you're kind of tending it in a way that makes it in the end kind of most itself. I mean, I think that's a nice metaphor.
Talk a little bit about the decision to create a character who on the surface is going to have a lot in common with you, and whether that felt brave to you or whether it felt at the time you started like really the only way that you could do this and sort of be honest to the story that you were feeling.
It kind of, I guess it just started to happen that way at the beginning. I tried to get away from it actually in the first draft, that T is actually a combination of two characters. From my very first draft, and one who was not very much like me, who was named T, and one who was kind of like his best friend in Prague, who was Asian American also. And then as I went, I realized that like I was just kind of exploring two sides of the same person, and that I didn't really need both characters, or that they even that both characters were kind of obscuring one character who was much more complicated. And so I didn't think of it as so much as being brave or not, but I did think of the ways that that we split ourselves into people, both personally and that our characters would do things like that too.
How much thought did you give to the history between Pavel and Katka that doesn't show up in the pages of the finished novel, but I wonder if it was something that you spent a lot of time working through in your head?
Yeah, I did. At various points in this, I mean, a lot of the pages that were cut were from Pavel's perspective or Katka's perspective or Rockefeller's perspective. I also cut, you know, pages and pages from T's father's perspective and other things. So that I had to think a lot about those things and just in order to get to the point where I could feel like I knew who the characters were. And so I did think a lot about how Katka and Pavel met, which, you know, did in some way end up in the book, and then how their kind of marriage progressed and deteriorated as Pavel's own sense of himself deteriorated.
What is your reading diet like when you're heavily engaged in, like, I don't know if you're writing every night or every day during the sort of working hours. How does that work for you?
It's a little bit different. So I'm usually reading, when I'm writing something, especially in a drafting stage, I'm reading things that I think either will help inform the writing process. So like right now I'm working on a book in first person in present tense. And I'm trying to read books that are also doing that so that I can kind of see how they're doing it and work off of that and think about what I'm doing differently or what I'm doing similarly. And when I'm not writing, I'm usually just reading more for pleasure and kind of reading, or even when I'm not writing, when I'm not drafting, when I'm doing more revision, I'm looking more at the books that I skipped when I was in the middle of writing so hard and trying to use books to help me write.
Having to have other projects along the way when you're working on a longer form work, is that useful or are they a distraction, but like you got to pay the rent and put food on the table?
For me, they're so essential. I get bored, I guess. I'm not bored, but I like, you know, I start to get in that mode as a child where you're like, oh, there's a shiny object. And, oh, but there's a shiny object over there too, right? And I just come to the place where I have tried to accept that you go where the energy is, you mm-hmm. know, and then sometimes you feel a little bit less energy for the long project that you're working on and you need to kind of consume something else or work on something else that will, you know, re-energize you. That I think of my, especially the nonfiction in that way, that when I'm working on essays, I don't think of them as kind of separate from the novels, that I think of them as a way to kind of get energy from similar ideas and then to, you know, when I've finished an essay, kind of redirect back toward the novel with what I've learned from writing the essay.
So I'm all about the shiny objects, which is why I think I chose a career where I've had a deadline daily, sometimes multiple times a day for a long time. I wonder how you help your students learn, because it seems to me that there is an inherent, you know, passion for writing and a gift for writing, but some of it, like, I don't know what percentage you think it is, but it's just about sticking to something and finishing it. Not everyone who is a gifted writer can do that part of it.
So much of it is, I think. It's what makes it so hard to tell who will kind of succeed or whatever, who will end up being a writer and who will kind of feel that their passions lie in other areas and follow those to other areas. It's, for me, you know, most of writing for me is kind of this, I think of it as stubbornness, but I guess you could think of it as dedication or determination. You know, one of the reasons that my book took so long and I didn't give up on it was just this pure stubborn sense that I had already, you know, you put so much investment into it and then like you can't give that up, right?
Once you are finished, have you formed the opinion that you have about the work, or is that also affected by, I mean, this book has been critically praised. I wonder how much that matters to you and how much you think it's important to pay attention to how other people feel about the writing.
I think it's very important to pay attention to how other people feel about the writing. But I wouldn't say that I prioritize what a critic says over, you know, what a friend says or what a stranger at a reading would say. That all of those things are important to me, that you learn some things about your book. Sometimes it doesn't come out that great. And I mean, the criticism is criticism and it can be hurtful, but maybe to my own detriment, I'm usually the person who's kind of reading and listening to what other people are saying, because I do want the writing to connect with somebody. And I think that connection is such an important part of it for me. It's why I like getting on social media and talking to people that have read the book or haven't read the book.
I believe artists when they tell me that they don't read reviews or criticism, but I don't know how they can stand the curiosity about, you know, how things are being received.
I think they must have people helping them. I don't know how you can do it either, although I think it gets easier as it goes. Like the first week I was reading everything, and now, you know, I'm reading less. It also kind of accrues, and you don't want to read, you know, 150 Amazon reviews. You're just, that's not the best use of your time. But yeah. People who are really kind of wanting to connect with you are really taking the work seriously. Like, those are things I am interested in seeing and learning from.
So lots of parents at least start with really good intentions and create, like, it used to be a baby book. Now it's probably some kind of online record of their children's lives, and they're sort of crafting their story for them. How much thought have you given to the kind of mythology that will inform your daughter's picture of herself and the fact that ultimately you don't get to pick that? That's going to be her creation.
Yeah, I have given probably too much thought to it. It scares me. I think, you know, when she was very little, I would walk around. I was living in Watertown outside of Boston, and I would walk around and see older kids, 7, you know, 13 or whatever, and think, like, it's amazing that they get there, right? And that you could do something wrong and you wouldn't even know it at that point. And maybe they're 32 and sitting in their therapist's office talking about how you did them wrong, and you just wouldn't have any idea.
Right.
And so it is a real fear for me. And I think one of the ways I would like to talk about it with my daughter is just to try to demystify things, right? That, and to talk about how things are stories and how important stories are, and how many stories are being told to her all the time, right? About what she should want and what she should want to wear, or what she should want to eat, or everything, like who she should be friends with. That those are all things that are in a way myths.
And is she getting that now at 4, or do you think it'll take time to continue?
Well, yeah, 4 is maybe a little too young for her to get all of that. Right now, she takes pleasure, I think, mostly in myth-making. It's so much imagination. What she wants to do all the time is to kind of make up stories and put herself and me often into them. You know, I'll be the boy who's never been to school, and you be the girl who's, you know, been to school for her whole... That's like the game we've been playing for the last week.
Maybe she's got the soul of a novelist as well.
Maybe. My wife wouldn't want to hear that.
Matthew Salesis is a novelist whose new book is called The 100-Year Flood. Matthew, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making this time for us.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones from Natalie Kalman-Kuhn. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.